The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor, a professional writer, and a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. His website is rusjournal.com. That's rusjournal.com. Now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist, and today we're going to deal with a topic that I've been asked to deal with, that I should deal with, and it's very important to me personally, and that is the political, social, and moral thought of the national poet of Ukraine, Taras Shevchenko, the most famous literary figure of Ukrainian background by far. He has long been considered the nationalist poet par excellence and the really the official writer and painter of the Ukrainian nationalist movement. He is the authority. So his aesthetic and poetic work is central to understanding not only Ukrainian nationalism, but a really useful cultural and ethnic concept of nationalism that we could use in our work in criticizing the regime and the New World Order. Shevchenko was a member of the Brotherhood of St. Cyril and Methodius. We dealt with Drahomanov, another member, last week, and of course the Brotherhood itself 2 weeks ago. And so we're continuing this singular theme of an intelligent, decentralized, agrarian, village-based ethnic nationalism as, at least under most circumstances, a useful and moral concept of the national idea. And I want to stress, and I've said this before and I'm going to say it again, that when I talk about the national idea, I am not talking about states or armies or bureaucracies. And I understand that those things, at least under most circumstances, are necessary. I am talking about the culture and the tradition and the history, all of this encapsulated in language that provides those other more bureaucratic institutions with their reason for existence. So we're going even more fundamental than that. This isn't so much a political theory, but a moral and social foundation. And that's what the cultural tradition is. Shevchenko, in his poetry, which I've been reading for many years now, and of course he was also a painter, he was born a serf. He was eventually redeemed by a German family in St. Petersburg. And so he begins his artistic life worrying about Ukraine as a colonized country, but also about himself and his own personhood, being born into serfdom, a colonized entity in and of itself. So colonialism, dependence, exploitation. This is something, I mean, these are the themes of his poetry and work. Not only concerning Ukraine as a society, the Ukrainian peasant as a class and a way of thinking, but his own person. Something that has been exploited and harmed by powers who don't have the right to exploit or harm it. Ultimately, Shevchenko is a revolutionary and is a national populist. To some extent, a social nationalist, although the state is not particularly important to him. It's the culture, it's the history, it's the tradition. Empire is the problem. Whether that empire be political or economic, empire is the problem. Empires enslave their own people, not just the people who they colonize. Because in order to create an empire and maintain it, there's usually constant warfare, constant class warfare internally, high taxes. It's always unstable. And so the Russians suffer under the Petrogradian monarchy as much as Ukrainians or anybody else. Ukrainian nationalist movement never had any problem with the Russian people or the Russian nation. The problem was always with the empire. The negation of cultural and ethnic nationalism is empire, whether that be the informal economic empire of the New World Order and the regime, or back then, the formal empire of whether it be Russia or Poland or Turkey or whatever. To Shevchenko, serfdom was a correlate of empire. They went together. The larger the empire becomes, the more frequent the wars and the instability and the rebellion, the more unhappy the native population, the more tied to their jobs, the more indebted they become. Empire wasn't just this political or economic imperialism. It was a state of mind. It was a state of mind that said that domination and control and manipulation are the normal course of things. It's a negation of truth. It's ruled by images. It's ruled by pictures and slogans and media and propaganda. The last thing that it's ruled by is the truth. Shevchenko believed in democracy, but the way we've been defining that word on this show has never been just this registering of preferences. It's been the very cultural and ethnic foundation of the people making it a people. And I've always been suspicious that really the central concept of the Brotherhood of St. Cyril and Methodius is Rousseau's concept of the general will. The concept that the public idea with a capital I in social life is not a simple matter of voting, but any kind of voting or any kind of political expression has to be based on that fundament, those fundamental basic historical traditions of a people codified in language and custom. So for him, an example there would be the Cossack era. The Cossacks, for all their flaws, and of course everybody's flawed, they really maintained a kind of general concept of the cultural, linguistic, and most of all, religious tradition within which the Cossack organization operated and has a lot to do with its substantial military success, especially in circumstances when they were outnumbered, which was normally the case. But for Shevchenko, there is no democracy unless you can articulate some kind of general will. Therefore, this endless mixing of religions and ethnic groups and races and political ideologies can never create a democratic society, because democracy must be based on a unity of purpose, at least in the most general of senses. And for Shevchenko, that most general of senses is the culture, is the nation, is the tradition, is the language. So from a political point of view, the ultimate issue is harmony over structure. Structure is unimportant. Structure is something that has to derive directly and organically from the culture. The harmony of the people have to come first. States don't create this. States exploit this. States don't create harmony. Any kind of just state has to derive from an already existing harmony of a population. But as he's writing in the 1840s and a little bit later, 1840s and 50s, it's the peasant revolution that can create any kind of legitimate administration in the country. So ultimately, Shevchenko and this kind of cultural nationalism is Rousseauian. Now, fraternity, brotherhood, solidarity. This has to come first. And he doesn't want to hear about things like equality or freedom or human rights or anything else unless you first show him the foundation of unity and solidarity. But while ethnic tradition and language are the central fundament, they then find their expression in the village. The village, the district, the region, the nation, these are all outgrowths of the family or the natural basis of all society. The family, the village, the region, the ethnic group. These are all, in one sense or another, based on the concept of family. And therefore, for Shevchenko, motherhood is a central figure, not just in a biological or moral sense, but in a social, political, and economic sense as well. The aesthetics of place, the love of a specific place because of its topography and its weather, and these kind of aesthetic things that bind you to a place. This is what creates the basis of solidarity. And he rejects, because of this fundamental conception, he rejects social divisions, and he rejects the concept of any kind of extreme inequality. Because if nationalism is to be based on the fundamental idea of solidarity, that implies that the extreme levels of inequality that you have in Republican or liberal societies in the West is completely out of place in true nationalism. And that's kind of what social nationalism means. It is based on the solidarity of common suffering. For him, independence is an extremely complicated and important topic. And in all my years of reading him and reading his poetry, there seems to be four specific aspects of independence. Independence means the dissolution of all empire, whether it be economic or political. It means the dissolution of all dependence that empires create. Dependence artificially harms the social life of the dependent people. Third, it implies a strong community based on self-reliance. Because if we're going to talk about solidarity and social unity, that itself implies a concept of self-reliance. And lastly, that true independence, and this is very much in harmony with Rousseau's thinking, that there is to be no real functional bureaucracy, or at least the absolute minimum of bureaucracy. And what Shevchenko is thinking about is St. Petersburg, something that was excoriated by Gogol and Dostoevsky, the artificial, fake universe of that capital city, where bureaucratic rank, and personal connection, falsity, was the main way of getting ahead. All major Russian and Ukrainian writers viewed St. Petersburg in the exact same way. Regardless of their political orientation, they all saw that falsity. The district of Kronstadt, which is in Germanic and Swedish area of St. Petersburg, where St. John of Kronstadt, of course, made very, very famous in the Kronstadt Revolt during the Bolshevik Revolution. Kronstadt got its reputation because that was the place where the city government dumped all of its poor. You know, its beggars, people who were ugly, people who didn't fit in, people who looked ragged, homeless people. Because it wanted to keep the central, the Nevsky Prospect and all of these central areas of St. Petersburg, totally bereft of anything but perfect, well-dressed people, perfect clean streets, and sort of neoclassical buildings. So the poor and anyone who just didn't look the part was taken by the police and shoved into Kronstadt so that the central part of St. Petersburg would look perfect. This is sort of the fakery and obsession with appearance that developed in St. Petersburg. And this is the stuff that drew the ire of writers like Dostoevsky and Shevchenko. The concept of the mother comes up again and again and again. The mother is the land. It's the village. It's the actual maternal figure, the woman who gives birth. It is the nation. It is the region. It is nature as a whole. And so when he views a country like Ukraine coming under colonial occupation, whether it be from the Poles or from the Russians, he sees a mother being trampled underfoot, being raped, being violated. And each nation is unique in the sense that it is a mother and that it gives birth to a specific form of art and music and way of life and way of thinking. Nations are distinct enough from each other that one really can't borrow political or social forms from the other. And in terms of things like metaphysics, Shevchenko and those like him see the Platonic forms not so much as these ethereal concepts, but he sees them as embodied sort of in the same sense that we talk about Jung's archetypes. These archetypes are, in fact, Platonic forms, and you could see them in these recurring themes, culture upon culture upon culture, taking specifically national forms, things such as the basic virtues, as the stress on motherhood, the village community, the cultural ties that bind, the heroic defender, the great warrior, the pious person, all of this, you could find culture after culture. They form archetypes, and their origin cannot be evolutionary, because even in Jung's idea, the archetypes came into existence at the same time as humanity. And therefore, they must be something that coexists with humanity, slowly developing themselves throughout history. And to some extent, you see this with Shevchenko, especially in the central concept of motherhood and the content that the worst sin is violating that motherhood. And that's what dependency and colonialism and these kind of things really are. It's essentially a political and economic rape. And yet, none of these understandings can really develop unless there is a developed will within the population as a whole, a self-awareness of this tradition, and this violation of this tradition, which is representative of colonialism. That will has to take some kind of social and political form. He did believe with the brotherhood of St. Cyril and Methodius that he was close to, that all Slavs are a single family. And as a single family, there is no one dominant one that can exploit the others, although some might be more powerful than others. Being more powerful is a historical accident and has nothing to do with any kind of right to exploit others. But even still, the existence of separate ethnic groups and the self-consciousness of this separateness provides the fundamental reality that itself gives a right to independence and an obligation upon others to recognize that independence based on this cultural tradition. The opposite of this is empire, which by its very structure and definition is based on the exploitation of the weaker for the good of the stronger. And in Shevchenko's mind, therefore, completely alien to the Christian spirit. Empires are entities that develop this central, humongous bureaucracy based on personal connection, never merit. And this kind of world, it's like American academics or the talking heads and on television. It's, you know, the people who really win in that competition are not your best. They're those who are more cooperative, your toadies, your conformists. These are the people, because they don't threaten their superiors, these are the people who rise to the top. If you're too good at what you do, you can therefore become a problem because you become independent. If you're mediocre at what you do, you have no basis to be independent and therefore become completely dependent on your social superiors. Therefore, bureaucracies, whether it be financial or academic or government or ecclesial, have a tendency to promote the mediocre conformist time server. And those of tremendous ability who come in and want to reform things are often treated very, very harshly. The smooth functioning of the bureaucracy of whatever kind, this is its purpose. Bureaucracies exist for their own sake, not for anything outside themselves. And nowhere is that more obvious than in large empires that have a lot of money to use to formulate their specific bureaucratic protocols. The anti-federalists, who, by the way, have a lot in common with this kind of small state ethnic nationalism, said the exact same thing. They said, if this Constitution passes, the Constitution that we have now, if this Constitution passes, the anti-federalists said in America, what you're going to have is an out-of-touch, alienated, bureaucratic establishment in the Capitol, caring only about itself and using as many resources as they could possibly get away with, having nothing to do with the country as a whole. And I've always thought that people like Shevchenko and Drahmanov and the anti-federalists in America have an awful lot in common in terms of their basic approach to government and empire and what that means for social organization and especially the distribution of wealth and power. Ukrainians and Ukrainians alone are to blame for permitting this state of events, this state of affairs to occur and justifying it. And remember, no matter who you talk to amongst the Ukrainian intelligentsia, they'll say the same thing. The Cossack elite, starting after the rebellion of Khmelnytsky, the end of the 17th century, in the beginning of the Petrine era in Russia, once this Cossack elite was given the chance to have serfs and have land guaranteed by the Russian crown in St. Petersburg, they forgot very conveniently that they were Ukrainian. You see the same thing in Ireland, especially under Elizabeth I of Britain. The same method was used. So ultimately, it's those who toady to the oppressor, those who seek to find a place in the system rather than rebelling against the system, these are the people who are going to get ahead. It's never a meritocracy. It's a competition to see who can prove themselves to be the most malleable. And I think every single one of my listeners has experienced this, whether it be at a university or in government or in a corporation. It's never your smartest who get to the top. It's those who are best capable of networking. But usually those two things don't go together. Because people who are genuinely intelligent and real critics and real knowledgeable people are the last people who are going to want to cultivate that particular vice of toadyism. And you see this condemned in Shevchenko all the time, his own Ukrainian people, and worshiping whatever power might guarantee them certain privileges. And so they're very easy to bribe. And so that's where this is the fault of the Ukrainians. This is not the fault of, the oppressors always need a fifth column. Without that fifth column, colonial oppression would be very, very difficult and very expensive to pull off. Shevchenko also touches on a theme, that I talk about quite often and has gotten me in a lot of trouble in the past. And that is the theme of socially approved rebellion. Sort of the loyal oppositionist syndrome. People who love to view themselves as rebels and clothe themselves with that kind of romantic covering And yet, of course, it is a phony opposition. It's an opposition that, in fact, entrenches the regime, because the regime can then claim that it accepts all points of view and that we are very, very generous and liberal people. But the official rebellion, and like in America, for example, it would be the chic neo-leftists and neo-Marxists of the universities in Hollywood. These are people who claim to be oppressed and yet are given $90,000 a year jobs at the university, so they can continue to claim their oppression. They claim to be oppressed and yet they have book after book after book published, their own publishing houses, their own television programs, and everything else. It's a phony rebellion. It's a rebellion to make their followers feel that they are true rebels and not just the mindless conformists that they really are. So that loyal oppositionist syndrome is something that he sees amongst Ukrainians, and that is particularly nauseating to him, because people follow those loyal oppositionists, believing they're truly in the opposition. And what they do is cement the regime even further. Okay, we're going to complete our discussion of Shevchenko and what is essentially this three-part series on the Brotherhood of St. Cyril and Methodius when we come back.
Don't go away, because there's more to come on the Orthodox Nationalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Nationalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com.
Okay, welcome back, everyone, to the Orthodox Nationalist. We're talking about the national poet of Ukraine, Taras Shevchenko, probably the most famous Ukrainian after Khrushchev, and one of the greatest poets of European history. His nationalism is deeply cultural and ethnic. It is, to some, in a very obscure way, based on the concept of solidarity and the general will, in Rousseau's sense of the word, but is also based on the idea that nations are not interchangeable, since they have unique experiences and unique topographies. They function in different political neighborhoods. They're subject to different empires at different times. They're subject to different types of oppression. The result is that the only thing that a nation could do to judge itself and to develop itself is rely on its own internal and interior resources. Warsaw can't be the standard for Ukraine. Russia can't be the standard for Ukraine. Only Ukraine can be its standard. It shouldn't be comparing itself to others. This country is much larger. This country is much wealthier. This country has a great arm. Ukraine has to use, and any society has to use, its own internal standard of judgment in order to judge and understand itself and its progress. Ukraine, the national homeland, this is in fact a collection of villages and organizations and brotherhoods and parishes and monasteries and guilds, all speaking Ukrainian and suffering under colonial occupation and suffering more or less in equal measure. The only people who generally do not suffer are the toadies, and especially those who pretend to be in opposition, but in fact are merely serving the system in so doing. And one of the ways that the system, speaking very broadly, one of the ways that empires rule is to invent social barriers, barriers to real fraternity, to empower one class over another, to create constituencies that are then dependent on the occupying power. The last thing that an occupying power wants to do is to see a unified, singular general will in its population. It needs to create classes. It needs to create organizations to socialize people, especially the future elite, into its particular ideological point of view. And Shevchenko and nationalist writers all over the world have seen that and condemned that within their own population, because the difference is between a real thinker and a real philosopher who normally could never be a part of any bureaucratic establishment. They're too critical for that. They won't be told what to do. They won't express themselves in these mindless formulaic slogans that were rammed down my throat in grad school. No. These people have to function outside of establishments. We see it in people like Socrates. We see it in Jesus Christ. We see it in people who were of immense influence throughout history. They never were a part of anything. They functioned based on their own moral authority. And it's the mediocrities who require an institution and money and prestige and the cocktail parties and all this kind of thing. That's the Petersburg mentality. And it's easier to live that way. It's very difficult to live the way Shevchenko did. And no surprise, of course, his own writings got him exiled and sent to prison many times. Class equality, in general terms, is a necessary correlate to national independence. And the particular theoretical reason is this, because if you have an upper class that was created and uses the ideology and markets of the occupying power, and usually that's how it is in colonial societies, you have this artificially created elite class dependent on the colonial power, these people will do everything in their purview and use their wealth and authority to thwart any serious nationalist movement. And I know I said last week that Drahomanov and Shevchenko agree in one very important area, and that is the destruction of the Ukrainian aristocracy through the Polish and Catholic occupation of Ukraine had a positive effect in the sense that it eliminated that potential fifth column. And they simply became Polonized and later on Russified. And Ukraine was a nation of peasants, which had a downside in that they're very difficult to educate and mobilize, but it had an upside in that they loved and were absolutely devoted to the idea of a basic solidarity based on a basic and fundamental equality. For Shevchenko, he comes to the conclusion that these social distinctions, distinctions in class and dress and fashion, these are lies. These are lies concocted by the regime to divide people from each other and to create classes rather than nations. So the revolt is against empire and the structures that it must create, the structures that it's in fact dependent upon. That's the problem. Not the people who, Shevchenko says, it's the Russian people who suffer as much under the empire as Ukrainians or anyone else. This is the central issue. Ultimately, a truly free people. A truly free people fear nothing. And a free people fears nothing because it has truth on its side. Truth, as opposed to the masks and the distinctions and the bureaucratic offices and the prestige of those who work for the establishment. Those people are mediocrities because they find it easier to conform. That kind of rule by images and rule by pretended sort of a pretentious authority, that's the opposite of truth. It's based on wearing a mask. Gogol makes fun of this in short stories like The Overcoat. The concept is that these social distinctions don't have anything to do with merit. They don't have anything to do with your ability. They have to do with your worship of the system. And your acceptance by the system has to do with one variable, and that is how malleable you are. To what extent will you permit the bureaucracy to function efficiently and not get in the way of its machinery? That is perfect for the mediocrity, the masses. That's perfect. But, and yet, it's the real, the only real intellectual, the only real critic is one who refuses to become a part of that and will suffer as a part of that. Solzhenitsyn once said that literature, means poetry and folk art, is the living memory of the nation. To those things that make a nation. The literature of a specific people is a way to encapsulate tradition, suffering. And the poet and the artist has really one obligation, and that is to serve those very people who brought him into existence in the first place. You know, in the mind of Gogol, and I know we've dealt with him on this program before, Gogol, you know, shares a fairly common view at the time that Ukraine and Russia are a brotherly people. They are equally gifted people, and yet they are separate people. They don't form a single nation. They form two complementary nations. And to a great extent, Shevchenko liked the idea and demanded the idea of an independent Ukraine. But as an Orthodox man, Russia was a great Orthodox country. The Orthodox Church in Russia had been distorted through the demands of empire, but that doesn't necessarily speak to the moral worth of the population as a whole. Those people speaking the great Russian dialect should be independent, not be exploited for that small class that benefits from the empire. And there's two things, you know, you read Shevchenko, and there's, you know, a lot of English translations out there right now. There really, there's two themes that come up again and again. The concept of alienation and the concept of dependency. The two are distinct, but not really different. They're two sides of the same coin. We are alienated because we are dependent. We're alienated from our culture and tradition because in one way or another, it is illegal. It is socially unacceptable. And ultimately, for Shevchenko and all of his poetry, the most complete form of identity is ethno-linguistic connection. Therefore, the only way to overcome both dependency and alienation is through national independence and the rule of custom. That is to say, the rules that have developed as a method of a society preserving itself in times of suffering, dislocation, occupation. Shevchenko viewed himself as a perpetual exile because he said and was punished for saying what a lot of people didn't want to say about the nature of empire and what it does both to the conquered as well as the people who do the conquering. Even Byzantium, from which Kiev and Rus received its religion was an empire and therefore an exploiter. It lived as an oligarchy. And Ukraine is going to start something new, and therefore it is going to return within the Orthodox context to the life of the patristic church. And the Kievan Caves Monastery is based not on directly Byzantine models, but on Athenite models. Independent, autarkic, autonomous monastic institutions. The concept of woman, as I said before, comes up again and again, and the concept of woman is the opposite of empire. Empire is something very masculine. The home, the hearth, the tradition, the church, these are female. And when these things are trampled on by the colonial power, it's an attack on the very lifeblood of the people. The female is not some feminist creature, brainwashed by the regime, by the system. Female is the keeper of the tradition. The female is the land, the hearth. The church is usually referred to in female and Marian terms. And the old Pauline concept, and you even see this in the prophet Hosea in the Old Testament, that Christ is wedded to the church. Christ is male, the church is female. It creates, in fact, its own family, enculturated within a specific ethnic organization. And what really matters in building solidarity is not on the pretension of the intellectual or the bureaucrat, but most of all, the simplicity of the peasant. To be childlike is not to be childish. Wisdom is not the same as intelligence. Wisdom comes from experience. Intelligence comes from books. Wisdom comes from the day-to-day toil, the land and family, and the suffering that the peasants have gone through under foreign exploitation. Shevchenko was very orthodox in his point of view. But like we said, when we talked about people like Lipitsky and the creation of the Ukrainian church in the 20s, a true orthodoxy must be moral, free, and national. National in the sense that it speaks the language of its people, that it speaks to the customs of the people, the local saints that the people revere, the local institutions, and their specific conditions. And in Ukraine, there's a great degree of cultural specifics that a foreign church could never satisfy. When the Cossacks defend Ukraine, they're defending the family, they're defending the home, they're defending the woman. No women were ever allowed in the Cossack camp so as to not distract the warrior from the real goal at hand, the possible sacrifice of your life for the sake of motherhood in general, whether it be national or the village or even the land itself. All of these are connected in the sense that they give birth to a virtuous life. They give birth to a life with meaning and purpose. And the last thing that the bureaucrat has is the mind of purpose. His purpose is only that of his bosses and his masters. So I don't think it's remiss at all to call Shevchenko a national anarchist, because he clearly is. The state is the problem. The state, although in many cases it's necessary, it functions as a parasite. It justifies itself according to the tradition of a people, and yet uses and manipulates and rewrites and changes that tradition to suit itself. This is something that Shevchenko and Franco and so many others were particularly sensitive to. Ukraine, ultimately, and this is the final point I'm going to make, Ukraine is innocent. Ukraine is a peasant society that is based on the simple wisdom of its life on the land. But that simplicity has been taken advantage of by the oligarchy, whether it be Polish or Russian. And so Ukraine, in Shevchenko's writings, is always that of the raped mother and the children as bastards. The Cossacks are the only defense, not just in military terms, but also in religious and ideological terms, when it comes to building Ukraine, rebuilding her, and protecting that, so to, you know, for lack of a better phrase, that cosmic mother. The land, the village, the tradition that Ukraine represents. And I know this has been Shevchenko dealt with every subject under the sun. But what I wanted to do here is really hit on the main themes of his work, but themes that he didn't invent, themes that he experienced personally in his life as a serf. The fact that he was a serf permitted him to personally identify with Ukraine as a whole. And when he looks at those who look to other countries like Russia or Poland or Turkey or wherever for protection, he sees somebody who has something to lose. And because they have something to lose, they're willing to ally with anybody for the sake of protecting it. That's the source of sin. That's the source of dishonesty. Again, something that comes from Rousseau to some extent. But the serf, the man who has nothing, the man who, in effect, is the property of somebody else, he is capable of seeing the world and social life for what it really is. He could see the underbelly of society. He could see past the images and the slogans and the formulaic nonsense of the bureaucratic elite. And so, it's this mentality, more than anything else, I think, that came to typify this particular form of Slavic nationalism, and clearly why the Brotherhood of St. Kirill and Methodius was so threatening to the Tsarist authorities under Tsar Nicholas I. So I thank you for listening. I encourage you to read some of Shevchenko's poetry, especially on motherhood, because it's just it is so saturated with philosophical content. It's just something that if you're truly sensitive to it, you'll never be the same again if you've never been exposed to this kind of thing before. It's worth your time, and I hope I'm worth your time. And I thank you for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com. Whoa!